The guns have fallen silent, at least mostly. For a month now, a truce has been in place between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and yet everything still feels dangerously fragile. Aid convoys are getting through, but only a trickle. People are returning to what's left of their homes, often nothing more than broken concrete and twisted metal. Beneath Rafah, fighters remain holed up in the tunnels, refusing to surrender. So the question is, what is actually happening in Gaza during this ceasefire? And an even harder one, is it truly saving lives?
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Welcome to In Crisis Mode. My name is Jan Jessen, head of politics at NRZ and a war and crisis reporter for the Funky Media Group. In this episode, we want to understand how fragile this ceasefire really is, what's happening diplomatically behind the scenes, and how the people on the ground are coping as they try to survive among ruins, temporary shelters, and months of trauma. 1 month of ceasefire. It sounds like stability, but the reality looks very different. What we're witnessing right now is a truce built on almost nothing. No political process, no reliable oversight, no shared vision. To understand just how fragile this situation is, we're starting with Jan Busse. He's a political scientist at the Bundeswehr University in Munich, and he's spent years researching the Middle East, watching closely how this ceasefire is actually holding. I asked him whether this truce is a step toward peace or simply a tactical pause.
So I think it's worth starting with a very important distinction. Donald Trump presented what's called a peace plan, but in reality, so far it's only a ceasefire agreement. And that's a very, very significant difference because a ceasefire only addresses very short-term factors. Turning it into a lasting peace is still a long way off.
He says both sides are officially sticking to it, but only because the United States is exerting heavy pressure.
The situation is already tense because we have observed violations of this ceasefire from both sides. But at the same time, and I think this is the most important point, we also see that the leadership on both sides still publicly commit to this ceasefire. And I believe that's fundamental. At the same time, we can also see that the U.S. administration continues to keep the pressure high and remains very present in the region.
What he is saying, quite plainly, is this. This ceasefire isn't holding because the parties actually want it. It's holding because Washington is forcing it. And even that is only stable to a point, because the interests of Hamas, Israel, and the United States are already starting to drift apart again. What often gets overlooked, without the Arab mediators, this ceasefire wouldn't exist at all. They're the ones talking to Hamas representatives, people Israel won't even meet. And they've built their own pressure, both for political and security reasons. He explains how Qatar, Turkey, and Egypt were able to push Hamas to compromise.
Yes, so I think the role of Qatar and Turkey was very, very central in reaching this agreement. But we shouldn't overlook Egypt either. Egypt has actually played an important role the whole time and continues to do so for various reasons. Clearly, because the Gaza Strip, the only external border it doesn't share with Israel, borders Egypt at the Sinai, near Rafah. At the same time, because Egypt is expected to take on a leadership role in the context of this international stabilization force, which is planned to be deployed to Gaza in early 2026.
And yet, without a political horizon, he says, all of this could collapse at any moment. The most delicate question in the coming months, will Hamas give up its weapons? And what happens if they don't?
Yes, I think that's really where a key problem lies. That was clear from the beginning, and the central question is how such a disarmament could actually look. I believe it's extremely unrealistic to assume that Hamas would simply hand over all its weapons from one day to the next. From Hamas's perspective, that would amount to capitulation. And Hamas has repeatedly said it would only hand over its weapons to a Palestinian authority. And that brings us to a crucial point, because I think this entire plan, whether it's the ceasefire element or any of the next steps, can only succeed if it's tied to a genuine political perspective. First, because that's the only scenario in which Hamas might even consider giving up its weapons. And second, and even more importantly, because it's the only way to truly withdraw support from Hamas and other radical groups.
Der Hamas und anderen radikalen Kräften tatsächlich die Unterstützung entziehen kann.
He makes clear, without the prospect of their own state, Hamas will never disappear completely, and radical groups will continue to be resupplied. While politicians and diplomats negotiate, medical teams are trying to achieve the impossible. One of them is Jan Wenens, a plastic surgeon at the University Hospital Bonn who has just returned from Gaza. He spent weeks operating in overcrowded hospitals for Doctors Without Borders. I asked him why he went to the Gaza Strip in the first place.
Was mich in den Gazastreifen gebracht hat, schlussendlich die Notwendigkeit, was
What ultimately brought me to the Gaza Strip was the necessity, the need to do something. And that brings us to one of the core questions. Is there enough aid now? I believe there's never enough aid to provide, even though this ceasefire has been in place for a month. People are still lacking the bare essentials, basic hygiene supplies, warmth.
A ceasefire, he says, doesn't mean there's enough aid. On the contrary, the guns are silent, but the suffering remains. Wynans describes how quickly the humanitarian system could collapse again.
Es ist trügerisch zu sagen, dass das reicht, das passt, das hatte ich schon in manchen Gesprächen so
It's misleading to say that's enough, that it's all fine. I've described in some conversations that we were able to provide solid surgical care. But all of that material comes from outside, through large organizations like Doctors Without Borders, which I was working with there. And everything is basically hanging by a thread, whether it's medical equipment or other supplies, food, etc. If that lifeline is switched off, all of it can quickly run out, and care can no longer be provided the way I was able to do it. Right now, it was the ceasefire that meant fewer patients with severe acute injuries were coming in, so there was enough material available to handle them.
Und man somit dann auch ausreichend Material hat.
Wynans is describing a system that could collapse overnight, and everyone knows it, including the people in Gaza. He also explains what is still medically possible in Gaza.
Aber wiederum wahrscheinlich auch noch mal eine Frage.
But again, it also depends on the cases. For example, when performing procedures on burned children or changing dressings, resources are quickly used up. Basic surgery. What does that mean? Attaching an external fixator to stabilize a broken bone, cleaning wounds, or amputating a limb when the injury is no longer salvageable. All of that is possible. But especially when it comes to consumables, dressing materials, specialized bandages, as well as painkillers and antibiotics, the supply is quite limited.
What he describes shows just how close the aid system is to its limit. One big explosion, one airstrike, and it would be overwhelmed instantly. How are the people experiencing this ceasefire? As relief or as an illusion?
Das ist eine Ernüchterung, ein Durchatmen, das jetzt damit, und das habe ich auch so wahrgenommen, begonnen
It's a sobering moment, a chance to take a breath, and, as I perceived it, a moment to at least start again today rather than tomorrow, to return, at least in part, to where a house once stood, or to the land itself, and to see what might be possible for the future. On one hand, there's certainly a sense of relief, but it's paired with a clear realism. These are people my age who have already lived through several wars. I'm in my mid-40s, and their children have already experienced three wars by the time they turn 10. So I think there's also a sense of new beginnings. And again, people are taking action today rather than postponing it to tomorrow. I find that incredibly admirable. But it's also a profound vulnerability, especially now, as people start to confront all the damage, physical, psychological, the loss of memories, and the people they've lost. And I think that's also a very tangible burden for many of my colleagues, whom I've met in direct conversation.
Auch vieler Kollegen, denen ich im direkten Gespräch begegnet bin.
What he's describing is a society in suspension, between brief moments of relief and the fear of what comes next. And he also says, children are growing up there who have already lived through three wars before they even turn 10. What does that do to a society, to its future? Wynan says it's not just the injuries that stay, it's the conversations. And some of those stay with him even after he returns.
Ich glaube, was mich nachträglich bewegt,
I think what moves me afterward, and I wouldn't say burdens me, because it's just the world we live in, it's simply reality, what moves me are these conversations, especially with colleagues who showed me, for instance, how their 8-year-old son had died immediately after an explosion or rocket attack. And these are encounters, conversations, where you really don't even have the words yourself.
Begegnungen, Gespräche, die, wo man selber ja auch keine Worte hat.
These are stories that happen in Gaza every single day, and they show this ceasefire is not a reset. It's a moment when people finally grasp what they've lost. At the end, I asked him what, in his view, is most urgently needed right now. His answer is shockingly clear.
Die Liste ist lang. Gaza braucht Frieden an allererster Stelle. Gaza braucht, die Menschen brauchen...
The list is long. Gaza needs peace, first and foremost. Gaza, the people need a life with dignity. Right now, even if houses can't be rebuilt overnight, they need at least more tents, more blankets, more warmth, basic hygiene supplies, and more food. Yes, you can see that in the past 2 or 3 weeks, things have improved a little, but it's also clear that everything is still far from normal. So in order to enable a dignified future, all of this is needed. Concretely, with winter coming, people need warmth, food, and a roof over their heads.
Und Lebensmittel und ein Dach über dem Kopf.
We often talk about Gaza as if it's a state of exception, but for the people living there, it's everyday life. And this ceasefire, fragile as it is, also shows even the minimum must constantly be defended, humanitarily, politically, diplomatically. And I think what you can take away from this episode is something very simple. Nothing in this situation is stable. And that's exactly why looking away is not an option. We cannot solve this conflict. But we can decide whether we allow a place like Gaza to vanish from our awareness. Because if no one is watching, then nothing happens. Not even this fragile ceasefire. I've often heard from people in war zones, it helps us just to know you're telling what's happening here. And that applies here too. So stay attentive, ask questions, talk about it. It's not a solution, but it keeps the issue alive. And at the moment, that might be the only thing the people there have. I'm Jan Jessen. Thank you for listening. This was In Crisis Mode, the podcast of the Funke Media Group. This episode was produced by Alexander Baumeister, who is also a journalist at one of Funke's radio stations. If you appreciate our work, follow us, rate us, and feel free to send your questions and topic suggestions to krisenmodus@funkemedien.de. Thank you for listening. Take care of yourselves. See you next episode. Ciao.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.